first half, second half, it's like chalk and cheese.
I can't have my best foot in front of it, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's no stupid red card, that's for sure.
We'll give you the balls so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh.
I'm not fully keeping it together.
Holding the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We are coming to you on the evening of Tuesday, November 17th, 2019. Rabbi Mark Goodman, you are in a new location in the house in Pittsburgh for this show. Why don't you tell our listeners about your new digs?
My wife is sick of hearing my voice through the podcast while she tries to fall asleep, so I moved to the newly refurbished scarf wall basement. So we have a basement room. My mom came to stay with us. My mom and stepdad came to stay with us last week. So I needed to like clear out the rest of the boxes and make it habitable. So I did. And then my wife wants this to be like her little like cozy nook of hiding. But I ruined that because I know she's lazy and she's never going to decorate it herself. So I went ahead and I just hung my scarves here, which this is like a great HTHL moment for you to write in with your marital suggestions to me. Like, after 11 years of marriage, is it a bad idea for me to just randomly come down to the basement and decorate the basement room that my wife wants with soccer scarves? Is this like an attempted compromise as a marriage, or did I like just invade her territory and annex parts of the basement in a negative way? I don't know, but more importantly, I got my scarf wall up, and I can recount really briefly the makeup of my scarf wall. I have two Riverhound scarves. I have one Mainz 05 scarf that is signed. I have a Woking scarf, and that's because I was making jokes to Richard Bamber, who is a great Rapids supporter and probably doesn't listen to this show since he's never mentioned it to me. That I would love for him. He went to England and I say, hey, I was joking. I was like, hey, bring me back a scarf from the fifth division. And so he literally did. He was like, oh yeah, the local club is fifth division. So I brought you a Woking scarf. I have one from the Bulldog supporters group. May its memory be for a blessing. I have two Rapids scarves. If you don't count the, Jewish annual. So I guess if you're going to count them all together, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Rapid scarves. I have a yellow. I have a burgundy. I have, the bulldog one. I have the gay pride one. And then I have Jewish community night, which is dope and super rare. And I actually have two extras. So if you're interested, if you're an HTHL fan, if you're a Holding the High Line fan and you are interested in a Hebrew English second annual Jewish community night scarf, hit us up. If we have more than one person who wants it, we'll draw lots or something like that. If no one wants it, Matt, I'll send it to you and you can have it. I might have two of them. And I actually have an extra of the Mainz 05. Anyways, long story short. And then I have one scarf from the Chipotle homegrown game, one scarf from Pride from LAFC. And then I have two half and half scarves, which making it four halves of a scarf. I have the Arsenal Rapids scarf that somebody sent me this year, which was awesome. And then I also have my buddy gave me a Chelsea Valencia half and half scarf from their Champions League game in 2007, which is so random, but I have it. I don't really know. Matt, what is the deal? This is a very Seinfeld question. What is the deal with half and half scarves? Are you, most people I know are anti. Are you anti or are you pro?
Didn't we discuss this already? I feel like this is a previous.
About half and half scarves?
Yeah, we already talked about half and half scarves. And I said I was against them for the same reason that I'm against all that stuff for like Super Bowls or any finals or any paraphernalia sports related.
Eastern Conference semifinal.
Yeah, that you get for like a final for an event that hasn't already happened, because in my mind, like, you buy that specifically for, like, you know, like a Stanley Cup final shirt. So you get like that, and then potentially your team loses either in that game or in that series, and then you don't want to wear it. So I would always, my view on that is, I don't want the half and half scarf from whatever match or whatever final or anything. I want the championship scarf afterwards.
Right, and, right. I remember now. I'm not so sure that this entire, like, that people really need to know about my scarf collection, but I think the general question of, like, what do you have in your scarf collection is always kind of fun. At least more fun than, say, how's your fantasy team doing, which we've already talked about as the worst pickup line in a bar ever. Where it's actually a great pickup line for a girl to a guy, or for a guy to a guy, but, like, for a guy to start in with a girl's like, hey, let me tell you about my fantasy team. Not a good thing.
Mark, you do know I'm in the MLS Fantasy Boss Experts League Finals. We're having a round of eight. Yes, we're having a round of eight for this week's round. So starting tomorrow, Wednesday, and then through to the end of the games on Sunday. I am the seventh seed, and I got pretty unlucky. I'm playing the two seed, Mr. Ben Bear. So I'm probably going to lose in the first round. But
My only goal of fantasy this year was to beat several specific people, mostly the editors of websites and newspapers who formerly employed me. So my goal was just to beat, you know, a couple of those folks, the folks at Around MLS, the folks at Burgundy Wave, and the folks at the Denver Post. Folks at the Denver Post were pretty easy.
Do you want to beat me, Mark? You're not beating me, for the record. I'm kicking your butt.
Is that true? In our league?
Yeah.
Man. But now we're doing it again. We're talking about half and half scars, and we're talking about fantasy football.
All right, folks, let's talk about other monstrosities of things getting smattered together, but are also ridiculous and also fantastic. You brought this to my attention, Mark. So, listeners, there is USL League One that is in its first year of existence. So it's technically the third division. So you have the USL Championship, which is previously just the USL Division Two, and then USL League One, which is the second division within the USL pyramid, within the whole of American soccer, third division. So effectively equivalent to League One in England, for example, or if you play them on FIFA. There is a team, Mark, called Forward Madison, that is basically the USL League One equivalent of Las Vegas Lights, in that they're a soccer team that was almost like designed by the internet and is more to be a meme than an actual soccer team. But unlike Las Vegas Lights, they are actually good. They're actually fun. They have ridiculous pink jerseys. And then they played, Mark, the NPSL side, Milwaukee Torrent, who are in the NPSL, for a trophy called the Astonishingly Shiny Cup. You can go up on their Twitter profile or on their websites, folks, and it looks like a giant dish that, like, you would, like, mix salad in. Welded on top of that and within that is like an old school shiny silver teapot, and then welded on top of the teapot is like a gravy or like salad dressing boat. Mark,
it's a big gravy boat.
This thing is absolutely ridiculous, and I know for a fact it is better than every single trophy other than the 2010 MLS Cup that the Rapids have ever won, and now I kind of wish that the Rapids were Forward Madison so that they could win and have this trophy in their trophy cabinet.
It's right up there with that armadillo that you can win. Isn't that like a thing that happens in the?
That's an old defunct like Texas. It was held in Austin, and in some cases Houston and FC Dallas hosted it. And I don't remember, but yeah, it was the Armadillo Cup.
Yeah. Here in USL, there's something called the Old Guard Shield, which is the original founders of USL. There's five teams, and they had a shield, and it was the ugly. It is really. I mean, I hope too many Hounds fans are not listening to this podcast for me to insult the trophy, but it is a really ugly trophy. Go Google Old Guard Shield. It's like made of like colored plastic. Like there's no metal in it. It's just lots of really gaudy looking types of plastic and off brand. Fake lightweight metals, and it's the five shields, the five something resembling the five crests of the five teams in the Old Guard Shield, three of which don't exist anymore. I think Richmond is still in it, but they're in a lower league, so they weren't allowed to contest it. So the only two teams that are actually still it's now just a trophy between Charleston and Pittsburgh, but the Rochester Rhinos, and there's one other team in there that also doesn't exist anymore. Maybe it's the Harrisburg City Islanders, I forget. But, like, basically...
it's the Islanders, Mark.
Yeah, there's only two teams left, so it's like, what do you do with a trophy that's totally irrelevant and nobody exists anymore?
Mark, I'm going to come visit you in Pittsburgh when the Old Guard Shield is in Pittsburgh. I'm going to stay in your basement, I'm going to destroy this thing, and then I'm going to... There was an episode of Last Week Tonight about a guy who, like, wanted to, like, wipe his history from the internet. I'm going to make an effort to make sure that all knowledge and history on the internet of this thing gets destroyed. This thing is ugly, and it should totally be replaced with the astonishingly shiny cup of all cups.
It is, and it belongs to...
It's the Bodie McBoatface of cups, the astonishingly shiny cup of all cups.
And it belongs to the Riverhounds. They won it this year with a 1-0 victory just this past weekend over Charleston Battery.
Okay. Well, good for Pittsburgh. Congratulations to them. I pity the person who has to hold on and maintain this thing and has to look at it every single day for the rest of the off season.
Yeah, it's interesting. Would it even be worthy of being put up in my basement next to my scarves, or would it besmirch the reputation of the scarves with its ugliness? That's a great question.
Let us know what you think on that, folks. And then, Mark, I believe there's also the Four Corners Cup. So the four USL championship teams that are a part of the Four Corners have their own trophy, similar to Cascadia in terms of it's just a straight table between their head-to-head games. So Colorado Springs Switchbacks, Phoenix Rising, Real Monarchs, the USL affiliate of Real Salt Lake, and then New Mexico United. I haven't looked at the standings of that recently, but given that pretty much USL Twitter is exclusively fascinated with the long run, I think it's 19 games in all competitions.
Phoenix has to have it. I mean, Phoenix has beaten almost everybody in the league. Of course, they beat those three teams.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In any case, are we good as far as banter topic on this, folks?
Oh, yeah. We've
okay. Spoke. So we will...
It's just me.
On Holding the High Line on our Twitter, folks, we will retweet one of the pictures from Ford Madison of the astonishingly shiny cup of all cups. I guess I don't know that I want to besmirch our Twitter profile page with the Old Guard cup. Okay.
Besmirch away.
Okay, so we will retweet or post our own photos of the three trophies that we've discussed now. And Mark, why don't you send me a picture of the scarf well so that you can let the listeners know what's going on with that. And we'll put the Old Guard at the bottom so that nobody scrolls down to actually see that monstrosity.
Oh, show.
Okay. Shall we get into it, Mark, then?
In we shall.
Okay, listeners, this past Sunday at BMO Field in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, in the penultimate game of the 2019 Colorado Rapids season, the Colorado Rapids lost for their first time with Robin Fraser as their head manager. A very, very poor opening 15 minutes from the Pids. Mark, Toronto FC with most of the ball in that time period, pinging it around and getting a lot of overlapping runs. A nice combination from Richie Larea and Josie Altidore sets up Tsubasa Endo for a shot that goes off the underside of the post and into the net from just inside the 18. Nothing that Clint Irwin could have done about that. That was in the 8th minute. 2 minutes later, Josie Altidore draws a penalty on Lawless Abubakar. A tug of the shirt. Yes, Josie might have gone down a little bit easy, but we've seen you put your hands on a guy and when it's visible of you tugging and almost ripping their jersey and he goes down in the box, that's going to be a penalty. Alejandro Pozuelo, who scored and missed a penalty against New York City FC in Toronto's midweek game, Mark, converts on that one with a Panenka on Clint Irwin. 31st minute, Keegan Rosenberry with a nice combination with Sam Nicholson overlapping into the box. Sam Nicholson sends a cross into the box, goes off of Michael Bradley, who was marking Keegan Rosenberry, gets back to Rosenberry, and he's able to finish beyond Quinton Westberg, who was in goal for Toronto FC. Fourth goal as a professional for Keegan Rosenberry, and he opens his Pits account. 62nd minute, Sam Nicholson with his best Benny Failhaber impression I've seen in the week since Benny Failhaber's shot cross that ended up going in. In any case, Sam Nicholson scores on that one with the assist to Keegan Rosenberry. Initially, there was the thought, Mark, that Diego Rubio had scored that one. Rubio told Nicholson in the huddle, and then Sam Nicholson confirmed it in the post game media availability that Rubio said he did not get a touch to it. So maybe I'm assuming with Diego Rubio being right up there with wanting double-digit goals that if he actually thought it was his, he'd be claiming it to say that he got double-digit goals. So I'm going to, you know, tip of the cap in terms of the honesty from Rubio there. Sam Nicholson with the goal in the 62nd minute. So we're tied 2-2 mark. Rapids get a little bit forward, don't quite have enough men back. And then Gallardo and Marky Delgado combine to open up a shot for Jonathan Osorio, who's a substitute in this match, and just a tic-tac counterattack goal for the Reds. And the Reds are ultimately able to see it out. You had a great opportunity for Kai Kamara with a header in the first half, and then Sam Nicholson draws a penalty on Westberg with a ball out wide, and Westberg has to clean Nicholson out in order to get to the ball, and Kai Kamara doesn't score on that one. So Mark, I guess we'll start it with you. You know, I'd say a disappointing game for the Rapids, given that they were in it and they had some chances, but, you know, it wasn't like they were massively outplayed. They just had some mistakes, had a really, really bad start to the game, and missed on some opportunities. This game could have easily been a draw, and very possibly could have been a Rapids win, especially with both teams going for it prior to Toronto getting their third goal. Mark, what was your good thing from the Rapids' first loss of the Robin Fraser era?
My good thing was that they played a really well-played open game. And the other, I guess, big thing on the good thing is that the Rapids went down 2-0 away, which at that point, I mean, you know, I felt immediately like, oh man, this is like every other season we've ever had where the team goes on the road, gets punches in the mouth, and then it's just going to be a train wreck from here on out. Like, there's nothing to watch, you know, and I was thinking like, geez, you know, I could really rack up some points in Red Dead Redemption 2 instead of watching this, you know, unfolding nightmare disaster. But I still hung in there, you know, like the Colorado Rapids themselves. And I was rewarded as they drew it back up 2-2, and then unfortunately wound up blowing it. But I think that those are some of the other thing was that they, you know, like back to the opening point, they played an open and fluid game. You know, I think one of the questions that happens with Robin Fraser as your new coach is, all right, he goes on the road. Is he going to become more pragmatic? Is he going to try and get points on the road? And if he does that, is it going to be more of what used to be referred to by some as the Mastronaccio, like the Pablo Mastroeni Catenaccio, which is an Italian, term for an extremely defensive kind of often like a 5-4-1 defense where it's like 10 men behind the ball. So no, it wasn't. I mean, they got down and then they played open and attacking. And even when they drew it up, they looked like they wanted that third goal. So I think that those are good things to take from this game. Matt, what did you see that you were enthused about?
I mean, I'll echo your point, just given what we saw from the stats standpoint. So if I'm just running down the actual chance creation mark, they outshot Toronto 15-13. That's pretty good, given they only had 42% of the ball. Not a super counter-attacking front. You know, I used to say, Mark, that I had a joke with an old friend from high school when we'd be watching the gold World Cup, for example, that just on the eye test, the average human being or the average soccer fan can't tell the difference between 10%. So, you know, if you see if it's a 55-45% right, possession game between the two teams, you think that they're roughly even. So 42%, like, it was pretty clear, especially in the opening 15 minutes, you know, that I would assume after the full-time whistle that Toronto won the possession game, but this wasn't Benny Ball. This wasn't DC United with their own goal victory over the Portland Timbers. So, okay, they were slightly overpossessed by Toronto. That's not surprising, given a good, talented, possession-based Eastern Conference team against a Western Conference team that's focusing on defense first. That's fine. They get 15 shots to 13 shots, so they outshoot Toronto. So, okay, that's roughly even. And then they got outshot in terms of shots on goal. Toronto had 7. Colorado Rapids had 5. Colorado has tried to emphasize set pieces a little bit more. They got more corners than Toronto by a rate of 5-3. So yes, Toronto had more of the ball and they had more of it in the final third. I'd say Toronto played prettier soccer. But in turn, like, the Rapids weren't outplayed in this one. It was marginal overall. You know, I think And I think the Rapids did a good job to try and get back into the game. And, you know, as much as maybe they were poor in those opening 15 minutes, whatever was said, you know, Robin Fraser putting a boot up players, you know, where in some cases, they came out and they were a better team in the second half. And I thought up until the 70th minute, they were the better team through that second half. They were creating a couple chances. Obviously, Sam Nicholson gets in the goal. And then at that point, you know, with 28 minutes and stoppage time left to play, you could think this game could go either way. I could have seen 3-2 Rapids. I could have seen 3-2 Toronto. I could have seen 2-2 with it being a draw. I could have seen it being 3-3. And this was a game that I was a little bit more concerned about, or one that I thought was going to be a real barometer of where this team was under Robin Fraser, in that they were playing against a coach who knew the opponent very well. Obviously, you know, maybe it's a little balanced there because Robin Fraser knows Greg Vanney and knows the entire roster of Toronto, but then also Greg Vanney, you know, has talked with and planned games for Robin Fraser, so he probably had a better idea than the LA Galaxy coaching staff or the Seattle Sounders coaching staff in terms of what Robin Fraser would have done in that situation with that team. Those are probably out in a wash, but ultimately the Rapids went up against a team that's better than them on paper, a very talented team, a team in which their stars showed up, whether it was Jozy Altidore drawing the penalty. He missed a sitter. He could have scored a fourth one there for Toronto. You know, obviously Pozuelo, you know, pulls the strings in the attack and scores on the PK and everything. You know, they played a good team that was healthy, that showed up. And immediately after the whistle, I thought, you know, the Rapids dropped points, but they were in the fight. You know, Kai Kamara misses a sitter. Maybe we're talking about a completely different game. But to your point initially, Mark, about saying that, you know, 2-0 at the 15th minute, oh God, we've seen this before. We've seen it under Pablo Mascherini. We saw it under Anthony Hudson. I'm not sure. There might have been maybe one situation with that, with Connor Casey, but, you know, the Rapids found a way to get back into the game. The key players, other than Kai Kamara, who you were looking at to really do something on the offensive side, were effective and productive players, and, you know, there's a very real possibility one more bounce goes the other way, and we're talking about the Rapids getting a fantastic result against a really, really good Toronto FC team. And, you know, Toronto FC Twitter is probably absolutely hitting the panic button as far as their playoff hopes are concerned, because they would have looked at it as dropping points at home. So, content overall with the, you know, happy with everything after the 15th minute from a performance standpoint, content overall with the performance, disappointed in terms of the result, but, you know, this isn't a Rapids team that got blown out 4-0 like they would have against Seattle Sounders. This is a team that wasn't as far away from Toronto FC as we might have thought that they were, you know, 2-3 months ago. I guess with that, Mark, you know, we've kind of already hit on a couple things. Where do you want to start with bad stuff?
There's only really one for me, which, is a pretty minor quibble, to be honest, but, there's no way around it. So strikers live and die with kind of having an above average finishing game. You know, it's just, a striker who has a bad day where they miss four shots, it can eat at their confidence. It can roll over to the next game. And it's really all they do. That's what they're there for, to be able to make the one touch in the one rare moment that they're right in front of goal, go into the goal. Like, that's all they do. Kai Kamara had a bad game for him. Technically he had two shots on goal out of his three, but one of his missed headers was wide open. The one that wasn't on goal was a wide open missed header that really should have been buried. And he also missed that PK.
And struck it poorly with that as well.
Right. By missed it, I mean he hit it low and to his right in a place that, as long as the goalkeeper dives in that direction, he's going to save every single time. It wasn't far enough to the right. It wasn't hard enough to the right. It was low, but at that point, he's honestly better going down the middle than he is going moderately to the right, because it's not far enough out that he can. Long story short, I don't know what he was doing there, and I actually kind of, I'm not really familiar with who has been the go-to PK taker for the Rapids this season. I guess it's Kai. I haven't really noticed.
I think Kai's taken every single one of them, with the exception of, I think, maybe Rubio when there was a suspension or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been, I spoke with Cole Bassett a couple weeks ago, and I was asking him about, like, wanting to take set pieces or things that he was working on. This was after the homegrown game, Mark, and he, Sam Vines was wearing the armband and hit the first PK for the MLS homegrowns. And then Cole Bassett scored the winning PK, and I asked him, like, is that something that, like, you've been working on that you think you could add to the game? And he said, yeah, it's something that I work on. I'd like to add it for a tool if it ever came up, you know, in a playoff game or an Open Cup, for example. But Kai's on PKs, and there's no way I'm upsetting him. So, I mean, unless, you know, I assume since this is the first PK the Rapids have gotten since Robin Frazier's in there, and Kai Kamara immediately stepped up to take it, that Frazier hasn't upset the hierarchy that was existing when he walked in, and the hierarchy was, it's Kai's ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's well said. I think another question that now that we're thinking at the end of, about the end of the season, one of the things that I'm thinking is it might be worthwhile to give Andre Shinyashiki the opportunity to start taking PKs to see if that's a role that he can fill for the team next year in the event that Kai Kamara isn't coming back, which is a medium to strong possibility. If Kai comes back next year, I don't know that he's necessarily going to be inked in as your starting striker. You know, I mean, I think one of the things that I regret the Rapids not doing 2 years ago was re-signing Alan Gordon to be your super sub off the bench to just wreak havoc at from minute 70 onward. And that's a great role that Kai could take on. Although right now he's still good enough to play the full 90. I mean, next year he's going to be 35. There's just very few big-bodied strikers who can put that much mileage on their bodies and continue to produce at the same level. And the important thing is to bring on somebody else who might be the next wave in Major League Soccer. And Dre might be the guy. So that's something I'd like to see, somebody else stepping up and taking PKs. But moreover, you know, like, The Rapids could have drawn this game 3-3. They could have won this game 4-3. Kai wasn't absolutely, you know, clinical, and that kind of had bad results. Mm-hmm. How about you?
I'm going to start with not having Jack Price in this game, Mark, who was out due to yellow card substitution, and Danny Wilson goes in there. You know, and we've, I think, fairly praise Danny Wilson for being good at a couple of things and being serviceable in that role. You know, if you're playing the 4-2-3-1 with, you know, five committed midfielders, if Danny Wilson's asked to do one thing primarily, maybe another thing, and he is the fifth best midfielder you have, you're probably going to be okay. But if you're asking him to do a lot from a distribution standpoint, or putting him in a bad situation like a road game at Toronto against Alejandro Pozuelo, with, you know, Kellen Acosta focusing a little bit more on the attacking side in that double pivot, you're going to be in a little bit of trouble. So I'm looking at this, Mark, the distribution chart that Toronto FC had for the entire game and everything, and other than a few long diagonal balls from the middle of the park, they're basically passing up through that central channel perfectly, and they don't get any confrontation in terms of mispassing passes or intercepted passes or crosses until you get to zone 14 that we've made a big deal on in the past in this podcast, you know, just right up in the middle of the box. And then at that point, you're dealing with Lawless, you're dealing with Tommy Smith, you know, maybe Clint Irwin's barking at somebody else to get involved and track back at Wells. So it was just, it was too easy in the middle of the park. Now that I'm looking at it, it was relatively easy for Toronto FC to just get into the final third, especially going up the middle. And especially given that the team had a really, really poor start, I'm just looking at, you know, who would have been those other verbal pieces there. You know, yes, Irwin's communicative, but, you know, he's maybe not Tim Howard, who's freaking out about the littlest things to get somebody, you know, in line if they're not really starting. That's not really Kai's responsibility, given that Kai's, you know, all the way up the field and focused more on the attacking side of things. You know, yes, Tommy Smith was on the field, but sometimes I wonder with either him making mistakes and then yelling at somebody whether or not he's productive, that was a role for Jack Price to start barking or to just take over things on his own in terms of locking things up centrally. You can't have Lawless Abubakar committing a PK by dragging down Josie Altidore in the box if somebody is in Alejandro Pozuelo's face to begin with, and he has to pass that ball out wide. Toronto FC can't get the ball out wide if somebody doesn't go up the middle initially on that goal, and I just wonder if Jack Price, both from a leadership standpoint and from an experience anticipation standpoint, could have put out those two fires. And you know, if nothing else, that first goal goes in, you know, maybe he and Tommy Smith start barking at everybody, and then at that point they reset to the point where the PK and the second goal doesn't come, being 1-0 at halftime, or maybe if, you know, Kai finishes one of those two chances 1-1, and then feeling much better, only having a bad opening 7 or 8 minutes is a lot better position to be in than being down 2-0 at the 13th minute. So that was maybe my one question, and then I guess, I don't know if this is a bad thing because it's not something the Rapids could have done about. This is an officiating question, but Mark, do we want to address Josie Altidore's physicality? And then I don't think you're an Instagram guy, so you probably didn't see his Instagram trash talk afterwards.
Whoa, no, that I didn't see that. You'll have to fill us in on that. But yeah, we absolutely have to talk about that. Folks, if you're not remembering clearly or if you missed the game, apparently there was a pushing and shoving incident between Lalas Abubakar and Josie Altidore, which resulted in Josie taking a hard fall somewhere around the 13th minute. And then in around, I think this was like minute 25, minute 30, Matt, there was a loose ball. They went up for it.
Abubakar wins it.
Goes for a header, and Josie is like steps away from him, and he decides to, you can see from his, like his, you can see him put his head down. You can see him not looking at the ball, but looking directly at the player's hips. And he just goes full rhinoceros charge, into the lower torso of Abubakar in an attempt to like basically take his legs out from under him. It's a pretty, pretty dangerous play. It's a clear yellow, which is what the referee, inevitably called upon him. But it was, a lot of people were asking the question if this was red. And to that end, Andrew Wiebe tweeted back at the folks asking questions about it. The dictionary definition, according to the FIFA rules, of what makes a red card, which included the phrases, a clear intent to harm, no intent to play the ball, and excessive force and brutality, like a foul with excessive force and brutality, which is, that's some really interesting language by itself. Mm-hmm. It also led me down this whole rabbit hole as a rabbi who likes to think about the interpretation and meaning of words, to think like, wow, the referees have been given the discretion to interpret the concept of brutality in an esoteric postmodern world. Like, what is brutality? What does it mean to be brutal? Like, was Josie pissed off and doing something exceedingly violent, or was he just not playing the ball and playing the man, which is like just the dictionary definition of a foul, but not necessarily the dictionary definition of a red card or a yellow card. So we're into like, you know, postmodern hermeneutics and epistemology, the questions of like, what does it all mean, man? What can we really know? What do terms in a non-symbolic universe actually represent? Yeah, I mean, it's, and to get less hippy-dippy, like, a lot of folks were just screaming, Josie's trying to hurt him, it's a red. One last thing that I keep thinking about in this situation is, often when a player clearly has no intent to play the ball, plays the man, undercuts his opponent, and that guy goes, you know, tush over tea kettle, butt over tea kettle, and falls down on the ground in a rough and physical way, that's going to get a red card. The only difference between that situation and this situation was Josie didn't get under Lalas enough to really dump him in a dangerous and violent way, which begs the question, if you try to hurt someone or you do something really dangerous, but you kind of fail and you don't really succeed at committing a very violent and dangerous act, should it be treated the same way? Should you still get a red card, right? Like, often we see a guy go studs up into a slide tackle from behind and get a guy really badly, and it's clearly dangerous and violent, and it's like a straight red. And other times we see a guy go in the exact same way, in a dangerous way, but he doesn't get all of his man. He kind of gets him from the side, or he only gets him a little, and the refs are like, all right, you clearly intended to murder him, but you missed, so we're only giving you a yellow card. Is that how it should be? Like, if you have the intent to harm, shouldn't we just play you a red card whether you succeed or not? So I think that's one of the arguments that a lot of folks on Twitter were having, which is like, oh, he was clearly committing dangerous play, he should get a red card. And the counter to that was, yeah, but he didn't really succeed, so maybe it's a yellow. It's pretty weird. What do you think, Matt? What's your take?
So first of all, Mark, I'll inform the listeners of what Josie Altidore posted on Instagram, and I don't know if this got connected to his Twitter or not, but in any case, Mark, it's a photo from the game. I don't remember when it occurred. It's in one of the penalty areas, and there's a scuffling of players coming together. So this could have been right around the Rapids PK. It could have been during a corner, a set piece for Toronto FC. It could have been in the aftermath of the collision that you just talked about with Josie Altidore going into the back hip waist area of Abubakar and then getting a yellow card. That occurred in the 59th minute. But in any case, so it's a jostling like there. It's clearly a very contentious moment for it, one that you would remember having gone to the game or watching on TV. And then in the caption, Josie put, don't get mad, get even. And then it might have been a couple emojis in there as well. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, yes, Lawless got, you know, a yellow card for the PK and everything, but I feel like if you draw a PK and then your team scores, that's getting even or making good on the foul. I don't feel like, you know, if somebody hacks you down in the box and then the PK gets called and then you convert the PK, that you should still have some sort of vendetta, especially when, you know, yes, Lawless committed a foul, if you ask me, and putting a hand on Josie and tugging his jersey. And yeah, Josie probably went down a little bit easy, but that's something that, with the way MLS is calling it, you put a hand on defender and they go down, especially when you are, it's obvious from the live look and the replay that you were tugging the jersey, you're going to get called for a foul, whether that's at midfield or whether that's in the penalty area as well. But like, that wasn't a violent tackle by Lawless. You know, it was he was pulling him down. You know, it's not like he punched him and then it was violent conduct and then also in the box, therefore making it a PK. So, you know, full disclosure, I didn't watch a whole lot of Trillian Cup when Toronto FC was playing Columbus when Lawless was with Columbus. So maybe there's bad blood between those two from previous incidences. You know, I know those two teams have played a couple really intense, you know, games down the stretch for playoff seeding and then in the playoffs. Even if you go back a couple years, Mark, I think I was the Save the Crew year when, not Josie Altidore, when Michael Bradley was asked after the game about, the team potentially leaving for Austin. And he said, you know, he basically said, I'm paraphrasing, you know, I feel bad for, you know, the hardcore fans, but you look at it, it's mostly an empty stadium. And if Austin's able to get a big stadium that sells out, you know, like Toronto FC or like Atlanta or like Seattle, then that's probably better for the league. And so on top of the already strong hate or discontent around Josie and Michael Bradley for their failures as the primary players of the last World Cup cycle and failing to get to the World Cup, that kind of doubled down for Columbus fans and maybe also Columbus players. And maybe that led to an incident, especially with Lawless being a talker on the field, to where those two individually had bad blood. But that's, you know, that's something else that's really getting into the weeds, you know, and the psyche of those two players. To your point, Mark, you mentioned some of the language that you were talking about. I would kind of just generally lump those two into, especially as a pro reporter who's had to use some of this language, you know, either violent conduct and then also endangering the safety of the opponent. I don't know, with the level of force and the point of contact and where Lawless was in the air, that you could definitively say that Josie was committing violent conduct. I absolutely think it's reckless. I absolutely think with how high Lawless is in the air and Josie with both of his feet on the ground, or, you know, maybe a slight push up right at the last second, that he's absolutely endangering the safety of Lawless in the air. You know, maybe he tips over and falls on his head or something. We've seen crazy collisions like that in the NBA, certainly in MLS as well. You know, just with maybe, you know, where is he going to fall at that point? If it's on his shoulder, his arm, if it's face first, you could look at a very dangerous foul, not only for Lawless's career, but just for his life and his well-being post-soccer as well.
Yeah.
So I always find it really, really hard, or if I were an official, I would find it really, really hard to judge intent in most cases. I don't think this case is one of those, because clearly Josie has no chance at winning the ball and is making no attempt at winning the ball. But you look at it with a 50-50 challenge and a defender gets there 1 second late, for example, and then just happens to get the studs up. You know, were they going in with a lot of force to try and win the ball? Were they going in with a lot of force with some sort of vendetta? I find it really, really hard to get into somebody's psyche and judge the intent in almost every single one of those collisions where everybody's like somebody's going after him. Just because Ozzy Alonso or Diego Chará commit really, really hard fouls doesn't mean every single foul they commit is with an intent to be violent towards the opponent. But I don't think that this is one of those rare situations when I disagree. I think I said this to you on Twitter, Mark, when you put out the initial gif of it, where I think, you know, if the orange card existed as it's been discussed in FIFA, I think this absolutely would have been an orange card for me, just based on the level of force that he put in. I think MLS refs have been really, really hesitant to call red cards unless it's absolutely certain. We could look at the Diego, or the Christian Pavone tackle from the game against the LA Galaxy last week that was initially called a red card and then reverted to a yellow card for some of the similar reasonings in terms of level of force, you know, was he pushed off or anything, and ultimately Pavone goes in with the side of his boot when the initial angle made it look like it was studs up or anything. So for that reason, I feel like if you're in the paradigm without the spectrum without a red card where something's in a position where it could be orange, I feel like the officials have always leaned a little bit more yellow unless it was absolutely definitive. And in that, I agree overall with the call that if I was the official, it would have been a yellow card. I'm a little bit surprised that they didn't go to VAR to at least give it a second look or look at something else. So I wouldn't have been, you know, if the referee comes back and decides, you know, with VAR, okay, that's a red card based on some angle they didn't have with the TV, I'd be fine with it. If they come back and just confirm the yellow card, that's fine with me. But just given how the game was going, given the physicality between those two teams and how it was kind of going to a boiling point, I wouldn't have minded the official taking 30 minutes or 45 seconds or 30 seconds or 45 seconds, not 30 minutes, to just look at it a couple different times from a couple of different angles, given what you described with Jozy Altidore, you know, with the sort of the rhino to the back of Lawless.
Yeah, just to go back to a previous point, I agree with all that, Matt. I think, you know, we're getting into the extremely minute detail of this one foul. We've spent more time on this foul than anybody.
Probably the rest of the game.
than anybody in the Major League Soccer world. We are giving the folks what they need. We are giving our fans in-depth analysis of the most intricate, minute details of one specific incident in one specific soccer game, because that's what our listeners deserve, Matt. That's what they deserve. No, going back to a previous conversation that we said about penalties, I looked it up. He's not the worst in the world. He's been okay, but most MLS penalty takers are a little bit better. Kai Kamara has 4 penalty kick goals on 6 attempts. The leader in the league is, of course, Carlos Vela, who has 7 goals on 9 attempts. And most MLS PK takers, who are the leader on their team are basically like 5 of 6 or 4 of 5. Like everybody has like one miss, which is pretty common. You're not going to be perfect. So 4 of 6, a little below average, but small sample size, folks.
Yeah. And if you are making a bunch of misses, Mark, then chances are you're probably not going to be the PK taker anymore. So, I mean, everybody misses Rooney and Cristiano Ronaldo and Lionel Messi have all missed PKs and taken them similarly poor in terms of the same way that Kai Kamara did. And not that I haven't seen anybody really coming after him, but, you know, like, this shouldn't be the, oh, woe is me, Kai missed out on the World Cup with Sierra Leone, and then now he missed 2 chances, like, let's completely get rid of him. I don't see anybody doing that, and I don't think we shouldn't anywhere be in that situation. Now, if he does that every single game for the rest of the season, and then maybe picks up a knock against LAFC, I think Robin Fraser and Porik Smith should revisit the, what role does Kai Kamara have with the team? Are we picking up his contract? How are we dealing with that in the context of the 2 open DP slots? But I mean, I wouldn't be shocked at all, Mark, if Kai gets another 2 or 3 goals the rest of the season, and if he comes back with the team and he's comfortably double digits next year.
Right, and there's one other aspect to choosing your PK score that I think is worthy of addressing, which is like it's really beneficial to have your leading scorer be your PK taker. So in MLS, most of the leading goal scorers on their team are also the PK taker, unless there are multiple players on one team who have lots of goals. And then obviously there's got to be one guy who leads the PKs. There's a few notable exceptions I thought was interesting. Safir Tider of Montreal has, I think he's one of the leaders on his team. I think he has 7 goals. And 5 of them are PKs. And there's one or two other players where more than half of their in the top, you know, goal scorers where more than half of their goals are PKs. At which point you kind of look with the shady side eye at them and you think to yourself, like, yeah, you're way up there on the goal scoring chart, but only because you get all the freebies. You know, I don't know that that's as legit. One of the interesting stats that comes out on American Soccer Analysis is that often when they're looking at GXG or leading goal scorers, they like to strip out the PKs because they fluff the numbers so much in one direction. So interesting point, not essential though for our purposes, but something we haven't really talked about all year, Matt, which is PKs. I mean, I think the Rapids were getting a lot of PKs early in the season that they converted, but that ultimately amounted to nothing when they were losing in the Hudson era. Now that we're into the era where we actually win games, we're seeing fewer of them, but also we've never really thought about them because they're not garbage time PKs. They're actually consequential, like in this game.
Yeah. One quick hot take that I've thought for a while, Mark, but I don't know that I've said on this platform, so I'll say it now because we're talking about it. I would be entirely in favor of PKs becoming their own separate category, so not included in the overall goals total, and or PKs being removed from consideration for the golden boot as well. Like, PKs should be in their own, like how you have points, but then there's what your field goal percentage is. Like, field goal percentage should be different from, you know, your, what's the free throws, like that should be considered a different type of shot for players that overall could be combined for points or, you know, goals plus PKs, for example. But, you know, I feel like I would be okay with those being separated or designated from a stat standpoint and that being incorporated into the golden boot consideration for MLS and other competitions around the world in soccer.
As you like to say, Matt, hashtag like retweet. I love that idea. I think it's a great idea.
Okay. Mark, let's go to big thing. Anything that we haven't really touched on from this game?
Yeah, I mean, it's really simple and minor and quick. You know, Robin Fraser lost. And I think it's super minor and it was inevitably going to happen, but I think it's still important for fans to experience the moment at which they're newly anointed Christian leader of the team actually stumbles for the first time so that we can come out of the delirious, bleary eyed love fest, sweetheart phase, that Fraser is in and go back to like the, okay, like he takes a team on the road and sometimes they take the L. That's a reality. And that's all there is to it. I mean, you know, this is everything we're still in, fortuitous firsts for this manager. So now we're just really hoping that, you know, that we're getting through the phase where everything's like, oh, it's his first this, it's his first that. And we're getting into the, now we're starting to understand who Robin Fraser is. You?
I'm going to say, you know, just again for the second or maybe the third game in a row now, nobody saw it or is extremely difficult for fans to see it. I know there was a rumbling I think I saw on their Facebook book that the Celtic on Market was potentially getting the game streamed potentially. I was watching the game from home through certain circumstances. So I can't speak to whether or not that happened, but this is, you know, still you go to altitude. And a TV for whether you're Dish, whether you're DirecTV, whether you're Xfinity here in Denver, and it says that the channel's not available because, you know, some corporate jargon. Altitude Sports continues to point fingers at the, you know, at the three cable providers who then proceed to point fingers back at them. So it's still a very, you know, one side says one thing, the other three independent sides, but acting in conjunction, say another thing. And ultimately, fans lose out. I went to Altitude Sports. You know, you go to Altitude Sports and you try to log in and maybe it just, you know, redirects you or anything. So this was a game that was still difficult for fans to see. And ultimately, even with the loss, it was an exciting game. It was a fun game. It was a well-played game. And ultimately, there's a lot of people who as the club is, you know, going about selling season tickets, trying to renew season tickets, they don't have that marketability because they can't point out, you know, hey, the team's playing well. They've beaten a couple of really good teams, especially at home. Robin Fraser's doing well. Like, this team is going to be different. It's going to be more fun. It's going to be more exciting, probably more competitive in 2020. Like, there's no hype up there because there's no, you know, because there's not as much visibility because people can't watch the games. And, you know, we're officially into the point that both of the throw balls, college and NFL, have now kicked off as well. So, you know, there's a couple Saturday and Sunday match days that the Rapids have coming up where people are going to be occupied with other things, whether it's Buffs, whether it's Broncos, whether it's somebody else. And, you know, this was just, oh, you know, maybe the Broncos game ends a little bit earlier with the timing. Let's see what else is on. Oh, hey, the Rapids are on. Let's see what's happening with that. And maybe they watch something fun, or maybe they see that the team gets a win. And that, for whatever that amount is, and I don't have a good sense of quantifying that, that doesn't exist right now. And ultimately, it's the fans who are paying the price with that. I was speaking with somebody familiar with the situation, Mark, who was not an official Rapids employee, but was just aware of what was going on from a negotiation standpoint. And they basically said flat out that altitude isn't going to have any nothing's going to move on this until the Nuggets and the Avalanche come back, at which point then the audience, the fans, and, you know, the general public who are using these cable providers want to watch those two teams and then don't get them, at which point then one of the sides has to blink or they have to somehow meet in the middle.
And so I have real concerns about this really hurting the team and really hurting, you know, overall awareness of the club. I feel like if you can't get on television, you can't sell your product for people to actually buy tickets and show up at the game. And this starts to spiral down. So I wrote a whole column a week or two ago about what I thought the likely outcomes of this could be, but this is up to cable executives at this point to sit down at a table and hammer out with a bunch of lawyers around them.
Mm-hmm. And so from reference point standpoint, Mark, in terms of when the Avs and the Nuggets would be getting up and when potentially altitude would have a little bit more vying power. So the Colorado Avalanche actually kicked off their preseason tonight. They played the Vegas Golden Knights, so they're already in preseason. A lot of these preseason games are not televised, Mark. And then the Denver Nuggets have their first preseason game officially on October 17th. That'll be into the MLS playoffs, and obviously the Rapid season ends on October 6th. So that's irrelevant. Nuggets don't kick off their regular season until October 23rd. The Avalanche, their first regular season game, an away game, is on Thursday, October 3rd. So I'm going to assume maybe with the Avalanche that the Rapids have a little bit, or that Altitude Sports has a little bit more vying power. But the point is that the other two big hitters, you know, the real money makers from a standpoint of Altitude Sports in terms of content and people just generally like, oh, why is the Nuggets game not on TV? I wanted to watch the Nuggets game. Oh, they're like, I'm going to call Dish and complain to a customer service representative and that's going to get filed up, or, you know, people are going to flame them on Twitter. That's not going to happen with the Avalanche probably until the last week of the Rapids season, and the Nuggets is going to be after the Rapids season ends. So in all likelihood, Mark, we're probably not looking at the Rapids being back on your actual TV, whether you're Dish, DirecTV, or Xfinity folks, until 2020.
Okay.
Shall we move on, Mark?
Is there anything left to move on to, Matt?
Well, we got the Rapids still have a game to play.
Oh my God, the season's not over. When will it end?
The season's not over. It'll end on October 6th at Los Angeles FC.
All at once. Everybody at the same time.
Yes, decision day. The ultimate, as opposed to the pre-anti-penultimate, the anti-penultimate, or the penultimate. I learned that this week when I was looking stuff up. We've used a lot of big words, Mark. But in any case, listeners.
Penultimate is a word?
Yes. So ultimate is the last of something. Yes. People talk about it. Yes, penultimate. Then the third to last one is the anti-penultimate, and the fourth to last one is the pre-anti-penultimate.
When would anyone ever have the opportunity to use that other than the fourth to last game of a season, to be honest?
I don't know, exactly. That's why I used it in the recap for Toronto FC this week.
Can I name my anti-penultimate girlfriend before I got married? The answer would be a big time no.
Listeners, this coming Saturday, September 21st, at Children's Mercy Park in Kansas City, Kansas, the Colorado Rapids will be taking on Sporting Kansas City Wizards, formerly known as. at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. We are currently, Mark, 30-34 through the 2019 Colorado Rapids season. That reduces down to 15-17. The Rapids find themselves in 6th in the Western Conference. They have 36 points off of 31 games played, 10 wins, 15 losses, and 6 draws with a negative 7 goal differential, and their record away from DSG in league play this season. 2 wins, 9 losses, and 4 draws. They'll be taking on Sporting Kansas City, who are just above them, 9th in the Western Conference. 1 point ahead, they have 37 points, and they have won fewer games played. They've played 30 matches. They have a record of 10 wins, 13 losses, and 7 draws. A negative 10 goal differential, though that took a pretty hard hit this past week, as we'll get into in a minute, Mark. And their record at Children's Mercy this season is 7-5-3. Mark, Sporting Kansas City is absolutely spiraling since last week. We saw them. They crashed out in against Monterrey in Champions League, had a bunch of injuries, and basically have not recovered since. And now this team, especially after Zlatan Ibrahimovic got his hat trick on Sunday, and the LA Galaxy got their 7th goal, pretty much just wilted. They're filling in gaps as far as their roster is concerned with the injuries they have, and in all likelihood, this was their last stand, as Peter Vermees said in pregame availability on Sunday, and they went out and lost 7-2 to the LA Galaxy. This is a team that is all but mathematically eliminated from the playoffs, just like the Colorado Rapids, and I'm really not sure where they are from a psychology standpoint and whether or not they're actually going to be up for this game that historically has been a rivalry game for them on Saturday. Eric Hurtado has filled in at forward in the last couple of games. Daniel Shallowy has not scored in league competition, and then Christian Nemeth basically fell off a cliff after the middle part of May. Roger Espinosa's still there. They still have Gutierrez and Sanchez, who are excellent midfielders, but just haven't looked the part or just been exhausted this season. You know, he hasn't done it from a production standpoint, but Johnny Russell is still an exciting attacking player on the right side of the field for Sporting Kansas City. Seeing him with Graham Zusi overlapping is probably going to be really exciting for me from a how far has Sam Vines gone this season. This is another really good barometer for him. Matt Beisler is in at center back, and he had a very, very poor game on the weekend, committed a penalty, and then he and Brad Smith, or Graham Smith, excuse me, you know, basically just got taken to the woodshed by the LA Galaxy. Tim Melia is in goal. Mark, we're familiar with this team. This is a team that on paper should be really competitive, but just like Toronto FC, they just got bit by the CONCACAF bug, the injury bug, and just haven't been able to recover. And I think this is a team that is limping into the final couple of games this season and is probably very, very looking forward to their beach-heavy offseason that is going to be ending after October 6th.
Yeah, I think you covered that pretty well. There were problems with this team at the beginning when they said goodbye to Ike Opara, and they replaced him with a center back who's actually now injured, whose name I completely forget, who is a European player, and that didn't work out. He was a downgrade. I think they thought that they could. That they were getting a player who was really a like-for-like switch for Opara, but instead they got – and they thought that Ike Opara was going to be on the beginning of the backside of his career. That proved to be a huge disaster. Ike Opara is the odds-on favorite for Defender of the Year with Minnesota United this year. In exchange, they've got Matt Beisler doing the best he can with a weaker set of defenders next to him and behind him. Another year older of Graham Zusi. You mentioned, Graham Smith, who it happens to be from Highlands Ranch, Colorado, and went to the University of Denver, was the 18th pick in the 2018, MLS Super Draft, and has been with Swope Park this year. But after that, you know, it's Eric Hurtado, who's recycled garbage from Vancouver, and I don't know why you'd take a striker from Vancouver and say like, oh yeah, he's going to work out great for us. He's not. I mean, Johnny Russell's fine, but, he can't carry this team by himself. And he's kind of been asked more or less to do that. Is goalless. And he also is, has like missed 7. That's what it is. He has the worst goals to expected goals ratio in MLS. He has something like a 7 expected goals and zero actual goals. It's unbelievable. He has missed more good chances, like mathematically, than anyone else in the league. And then, you know, after that, it's just, there's nothing there. There's a lot of very deeply lacking players. Christian Nemeth came back from Saudi Arabia and hasn't been particularly useful in any way, shape, or form. So that's Sporting. And then the last thing I'll add to this all is, one of my favorite phrases, I was going to lead with this, but then I forgot. I got excited about other things. But one of my favorite phrases in the world of all time is, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that is very much the way this offense is set up to run. Sporting Kansas City's identity has long been possession-based football. They're going to beat you because you're not going to have the ball. The best way for them to defend is for you to not have any chance to attack because you don't have the ball. And when that doesn't work and you don't have a backup plan, you're in big, big doo-doo. Like, you have big, big problems. And that's Sporting. Sure, they can kick the ball around, but it's mostly meaningless. They can't really score. And when they give away balls at midfield, that back line is really porous. I think Graham Smith is a fine defender, and Matt Beisler certainly has a good reputation. I think he's young, Graham Smith is, and I think he's new, and he's not ready to be thrust in and kind of taken to school to learn the job this year. And also the defensive midfielders in front of him aren't really defensive midfielders. He's got Ely Sanchez, who's okay, but he's really more of an eight. And Felipe Gutierrez, who's not a defensively minded guy. He's really a distributor kind of, registra kind of player. So you don't really have anybody shielding that back line. So when they turn it over, they're in trouble. So that's my long-winded discussion of Sporting. They're in bad shape. And I also think we're at the phase of the year where there's a crisis of confidence. They aren't winning games and they know they are not winning games. That being all said, the last thing I'll conclude with is this. They just got shellacked 7-2 by the LA Galaxy. It is very unlikely that they will come out as flat as they did against them. And it is very unlikely that they will use that humiliation as fuel for the fire to create a turnaround. So I feel like they got schwacked. And it's to the Rapids' disadvantage because Sporting will want to turn it around, and they'll want to turn it around against the Rapids.
Mm-hmm. No, I think those are all good points there, Mark. I think the thing is with me is, other than Johnny Russell just making something happen on his own, I'm not really threatened by anything this team is doing offensively.
Right.
You know, I think Gutierrez is going to have enough to worry about in the midfield with Jack Price back in there. So as long as Sam Vines, you know, doesn't completely crap the bed, you know, 1v1 against Johnny Russell or Graham Zusi overlapping, I'm not really concerned about Sporting Kansas City doing anything. I think Jack Price slots back into the midfield next to Kellen Acosta in the 4-2-3-1, and, you know, they look at the film to reacquaint themselves with Johnny Russell, with Gutierrez, who I think had a brace on the weekend with a couple of shots from distance. So definitely get pressure on him when he's within 30 yards of goal, just like they didn't do that against Alejandro Pozuelo. So in that respect, some of the issues that the Rapids had against Toronto were things that they clearly were going to do in film anyways, with what Robin Fraser was just looking at, focusing on fixing mistakes. And it's fortuitous that the things that they didn't do well against Toronto are things that were probably going to work on anyways this week, and things that they need to do well against Sporting Kansas City. But other than that, just with where this defense is, you know, with Melia being down, Matt Beisler looking extremely tired as well, I'm not really threatened by the Rapids are going to be able to get chances and are going to be able to do things against Sporting Kansas City. I'm really excited to see what a Jonathan Lewis could do, for example, against a 33-year-old Graham Zusi with him going upfield. So I think the Rapids go there You know, I think just like Toronto, they probably have somewhere between, you know, maybe 41 and 46% of the ball. You know, they focus on, you know, frustrating Sporting Kansas City by letting them have the ball and not really create anything. And they break out with the counterattack and they force Sporting Kansas City to defend in the air with balls up to Kai Kamara and force their wide players to do a lot of work defensively as well. And especially on set pieces, I think the Rapids are going to be equally as dangerous. This is a game that I would expect the Rapids to get a result in. And it's a game that I think that the Rapids definitely could win. I think maybe the question that I have to your point, Mark, about Sporting Kansas City getting absolutely shellacked by the LA Galaxy and then wanting to respond to that and actually put whatever fight they can in terms of how much, you know, their, you know, 1.1% chance of making the playoffs is or whatever it is at 538 right now. They're going to want to be able to get a result against the Rapids. I think maybe the one thing that I'm wondering is if maybe not throw in the towel, but if Peter Vermees maybe thinks that, okay, we're not going to do anything. The guys are tired. Like, let me shut down Matt Beisler. Let him get healthy. Let me shut down Roger Espinosa, who came out in the game against the LA Galaxy, and maybe give some of the younger kids, you know, the Gianluca Busios, Daniel Shallowy, who's still a young player, you know, maybe just rotate the squad to focus more on getting some young kids some opportunities. And if that happens, then I think that's going to benefit the Rapids from the standpoint of just having lesser quality players that we're used to with Sporting Kansas City. But I think this is a team that I think desperately needs to get away from each other and get away from playing soccer, get their players get healthy. Peter Vermees will probably cut out some of the dead weight with some big decisions, you know, and leave some big salaries, you know, unpicked up in terms of their 2020 options or available in the expansion draft, that Nashville is going to be participating in, and then probably go after a big striker. You know, if they get rid of Nemeth, who's been really disappointing, Johan Croze, who's been a disappointment as a designated player, that's probably puts them in position to get, you know, a Felipe Gutierrez level contract. And then if they get in somebody who's just a competent center forward and have a fully healthy and operational defense in 2020, that does not have to worry about playing Champions League right off the bat, I think they're going to be better for it. But they just got bit by that bug. And I think as soon as things started to turn in the summer, I think we knew the direction that they're in. I guess the question is this a wounded animal that is going to come out fighting for its lives with the little playoff opportunity, chances of making the playoff that it has right now? Or is this something to where the Rapids are going to get a counterattack, Jonathan Lewis is going to cut inside, whip a ball to the back post, and you know, Kai Kamara, who will probably be working on his header finishing all season, is just going to dunk on Tim Melia 10 minutes in. And then at that point, heads are going to drop and the Rapids are going to roll over them. I think that's just the real question I have. Either way, this is going to be a fantastic exercise for the Rapids to right the wrongs against Toronto or face a team that has historically given them trouble. You know, and get a result on them with a team that is improving as Sporting Kansas City continues to slide. I think those are the two narratives that it's going to be one of those two outcomes. And I think regardless of which version of Sporting Kansas City shows up and adjusts to getting punched in the mouth by the Rapids, I think the Rapids are going to be able to get a result on Saturday.
Well said.
Do we want to do predictions, Mark?
Feels like Colorado win this one. Even though I feel like Sporting are gonna come back at them, but it just feels like the big momentum is still in Colorado's direction despite the loss last week. So I'll go 2-0.
I'll take 2-1 in this game. You know, I think that Sporting Kansas City will change something up offensively, or you'll just get a moment of magic from Gutierrez like he had with his two goals against the Galaxy over the weekend, or maybe Johnny Russell just besting Sam Vines with all the best that he could do. But I mean, Kai Kamara missing two, you know, should have had a brace on the weekend. Kai Kamara returning back to Sporting Kansas City for the first time since the whole kerfuffle with Doug McIntyre and the article that he had, you know, about Peter Vermees saying that Kai wasn't really about the team at the time. Kai Kamara is an extremely petty human being. I think he's going to roll into Children's Mercy Park on Saturday with an absolute vengeance, and I think he gets a brace and the Rapids win the game 2-1. That does it for us, folks. Shall we get out of here, Mark?
Let me get out of this basement.
Okay. Listeners, you can follow us individually on Twitter at LWSMattPollard, at soccer_rabbi, lastmoononsoccer.com, and rabbimarkastergoodman.com/soccer_rabbi for our written content. Follow us as a podcast on Twitter at Rapids96Podcast, Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com if you want to email us. Rate, review, subscribe, share on social media wherever you get your podcasts. We're on pretty much anywhere you would want us to be, including the platform that you're listening to us right now, obviously. I'll edit this.
Or not. It's kind of fun when we don't. It'd be a nice little Easter egg for the 8 people still listening at the end of the podcast.
All right, Mark, I'm leaving it in. Okay, in any case, patreon.com/Rapids96Podcast and denverpost.com/HTHL, all lowercase, if you believe we bring you monetary value. With that, listeners, we'll see you next week.